Hello everyone, welcome to the Duck over on the bay, the bonny banks of Loch Lomond, where we're joined by Zendaya and Zac Efron in the background and a dozen families sat around and about with a few screaming kids, so bear with us. But the guest who I am excited is here is David Jones. David, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much for having me, Sam.
So, David, why don't you tell people your Twitter handle, who they may know you a little better off?
Well, my Twitter handle is UKGolfGuy. For Instagram followers, I was quite a significant amount slower off the mark, so I am the UK Golf Guy there, just to be really confusing.
There's another one.
Although he hardly ever posts, which really annoys me.
Well, we're glad that you do post, because you've racked up a bit of a following now, especially on Twitter, haven't you?
Yeah, Twitter's gone well. I mean, I think I'm really sad. I've got a little chart, this is really geeky, which says how many followers I've had from my early days of Twitter. I think I first went on it 2009 or something. And I think it's something like it took me 8 years to get 1,000, and it's pretty much now kind of got twice that every year. So I'm up to almost 20,000 now. So yeah, it took quite a long time to get there, though.
Get the stone rolling. And
exactly.
Brilliant. So David, now you have a career in golf. You work in the golf travel world especially, but that wasn't always the case. And I persuaded you onto the podcast to talk about how that career has changed, because it's one of the most common questions I have. How do you actually get into the golf industry?
Yeah, and it's one that whenever I post a picture of me being on a nice golf course, I always get a few people saying, how do I get your job? and I don't know if they think I actually have a job, to be honest with you. So interrupt me when it gets really boring.
Start from the beginning. Okay. That's an interest. It's just such a fascinating change of life.
Yeah, it is. So I went to university up in Aberdeen. I've actually lived in Scotland. I'm 49. I moved up to Scotland when I was 10 and have lived here most of the time since. Still don't have the accent.
No.
Some people are so disappointed. They think I'm going to have this wonderful Scottish accent and then they can hear the southeast of England coming out still. But I moved up when I was 10, went to school in Edinburgh, went to university up in Aberdeen, did a degree in politics and international relations, and then straight out of there joined Procter & Gamble, who is a big blue chip US company. That was back in the days when there was a milk crown still. It was, you know, a big plum job. And I worked there on the brand and marketing side, to begin with in the northeast of England, and then they moved us all to Geneva. So lived in Geneva for quite a few years. I launched Pringle Crisps into 12 markets in Europe.
Wow.
Yeah. Sampled plenty of them along the way. I ran the Pampers business in the UK. So all kinds of things you find in your house.
Brilliant. And that was sort of that industry and the big trip business. Did you think that's what you're going to be doing for forever?
I mean, it was a great commercial grounding and a great marketing. You know, Procter & Gamble was all about looking into insights into consumers' lives, how you can produce products which are good for them. But I did that for about 7 years and decided, actually, I wanted to move back to Scotland. So a job came up at Royal Bank of Scotland before Royal Bank of Scotland became the thing it is now. That was about 2005. I worked there for a couple of years. And just before the crash, I hastened to add.
Interesting couple of years.
Yeah, it was. And I worked, I wouldn't say close to Fred Goodwin, but I witnessed him at first hand, which is a whole different podcast for a different subject. I then went to Virgin. So a few of us went to Virgin Money. And we basically, during the financial crisis of 2007, were very active in looking at what opportunities there were. And we took over Northern Rock. I was the commercial director, hardcore proper banking, which hadn't been my background. So one of those things, and actually it probably applies a little bit to what I'm doing now, having to learn quite quickly about a different industry. So I did that for a few years. I went to Money Supermarket, which you might remember those annoying adverts from a few years ago. I was the managing director there, so ran that business, which was absolutely fantastic. So lots of different things. And then my last role was at Sainsbury's Bank, which was good because it was in Edinburgh. I've got a family, and we live in East Lothian. But when that job came to an end, kind of the beginning of COVID, it was a bit of an inflection point. Do I want to go again into a corporate job? And I kind of didn't. So that's when I had to think about what else I could do.
You felt like you were done. Because it must have been a stressful couple of years. Northern Rock was right in the middle of the 2008, especially, wasn't it? That was when everyone was on a 12% mortgage or something going bankrupt.
Yeah, it was. But I guess we were in the position of coming in as the White Knight to save it.
Yeah.
And look, I won't pretend I was at all close to the man, but I spent a bit of time with Richard Branson and observing him and the way he operated through that. Had various meetings with the Treasury, with really senior people in the government, and that was absolutely fascinating. So even though it was a very tough time for the economy, personally, I got a lot out of it, and I certainly grew a lot as an individual through that time.
Yeah, and as a business person.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, talk to me then about golf, because that's that lifestyle and the corporate world doesn't leave a great deal of time to be playing golf, I can't imagine.
No, so I played golf as a kid. I was in Essex, as I said, till I was about 10 or 11. My father was a keen golfer, kind of a 11 handicapper. He was a member of a place called Thorndon Park, which is Essex's number one
is
golf
that a
course.
Harry Colt course.
It is a Colt course. Say Essex is number one. I will leave it there because I don't want to offend any of your Essex listeners, of which I'm sure there are many. So I used to go up with him after school in the evenings, kind of walk around with him, hit a few balls, and really got into it that way. Then we moved up to Edinburgh, and in Edinburgh it was great because there was suddenly so many opportunities to play. I used to pay 50p a round at Carrick now.
Wow.
Braidshill, Silvernows. Silvernows famously had the longest par 5 in Scotland, the 18th hole, which I played many times uphill into the wind, into the rain, and hated most of it. But look, Edinburgh was a great place as a kid because there's so much golf. This was 1980, well, probably 87, 88. I was playing a lot, and it was only going to be 50p for the day. And I'd be dropped off at the course in the morning and picked up late in the evening, which sounds like that should finish well, and that's why I turned to become a pro golfer. But you've seen me play golf, and that was never an option.
Well, we've just had a beautiful morning on Loch Lomond, haven't
yeah,
we?
Yeah, yeah.
And yeah, maybe neither of us are going to be turning professional, but what a day, what a morning, what a spot that is.
Scotland's such a great place to play golf. And actually, then I went up to, as I said, uni in Aberdeen, and I kind of didn't play up there, just had so much other stuff on. I was very active in student politics, active in amateur dramatics, not very active in academic studies, but did enough to get through with a degree. So didn't really play much golf for a few years. And then when I ended up in Switzerland, I was going around Europe a lot. Didn't have any kids, just got married. So we used to go away for weekends. I'd be away a lot during the week for work and often take the clubs with me. And started discovering, I guess, a lot of golf courses around Europe. And while I've played a lot in the UK, I've been lucky to play in other parts of the world. Probably Europe was the place I played the most to begin with, and saw some really interesting golf courses and had a really close group of friends. And we used to do that a lot, you know, before we had kids, before those things, we'd go away, not every weekend, but a lot all over the place. So that's really when I got a bit of the bug for it again. And then when we moved back to the UK, we came back up to Edinburgh. Spent a little bit of time in central Edinburgh, and then we're going to start a family. Had a discussion which way to go, and East Lothian was the only choice.
East Lothian's got to be the winner.
So I live bang in the middle of Gullen, which is just, you know, the most idyllic place to play golf. I can't imagine ever living anywhere else, to be honest with you.
No.
So I played a lot, and always enjoyed discovering other courses. And then, I couldn't tell you exactly when, probably 8 or 9 years ago, decided just to put together a little website called UK Golf Guy. I came up with the name, I couldn't even tell you how, but it was a spur of the moment thing. Registered that URL. In fact, that's what I did. I probably waited to see what URLs were available, and that one was. Registered that, and the only intention I had with that was as a blog, as a place for me to record the different courses I'd played.
Yeah.
And I had a bit of a ranking system which I used. And it was just to have a record. It wasn't really intended for anything apart from me and a few friends.
Yeah. Well, we'll talk about golf ranking because that's something you do a lot of. But I'm just trying to work out time frames. So was the UK Golf Guy, was doing that, starting that, was that a bit of escapism from a busy work at that point? Or had you had the opportunity to spend a bit more time focused on the golf?
I think it was actually when I was between jobs, I had a bit of garden leave between one job and the next job. And during that time, I just set myself a little project. I'm the kind of person who always has to have a project on the go or several projects on the go. It's just my nature. And I think I just thought that was a nice way to spend a bit of time. It was over January and February when there wasn't much else to do. So I got an account with Squarespace, which is very easy to use, and really set it up from there.
Yeah, brilliant. So, okay, so talk to me time frame. So when did you make this realization or have this turning point where you decided, I'm going to stay in the golf industry, I'm going to work in golf rather than go and find another corporate job?
And I probably wouldn't pretend it was a huge epiphany, but over COVID, when I finished my my previous job, you know, it the easiest thing really for me would have been to go back into another corporate job. And there were various people wanted to have conversations about that. But I'd been doing that then for, well, best part of 20 years, over 20 years. And really wasn't sure that I wanted to do that, especially in the financial services industry, which I was in. Incredibly heavy regulation. Frankly, the work was pretty dull at times, but remunerated really well. But I didn't really want to do that again. And I had been building up the profile on Twitter. I love taking pictures of golf courses, and that seemed to resonate. I also just like having interaction with people on social media. I think that's just the way I tend to run that account, is that I really like hearing what other people think and engaging. So I had a good level of engagement. But I didn't have a master plan for enter the golf industry. What does that look like? I did a bit of writing for a couple of magazines on the back of, you know, 10 years of posting things on social media and writing articles on my blog. So I did a little bit of that. I did a bit of drone photography, which a couple of clubs had seen and wanted to pick that up as well. So again, I had some thoughts about maybe that's going to be an income stream. But to be really honest with you, when you look at, you'll know this, how much money there is in writing articles and taking pictures. Even the guys who I've met who are really, really good at that and world leaders at that have multiple other income streams as well. And I think that was probably something I realized quite early, which is if I do want to do something in golf, I can't put everything into one hope. I kind of need to have a few different options going there. So I looked at the travel area as well, and thinking, and I guess there was a bit of an insight here for me, which is quite a few people say to me over the years or have said they'd really like to go on a golf trip, which is a bit away from the normal. And if you're listening in the UK, trip to Spain, yeah, or trip to Portugal with the mates, because they're a bit nerdy or they are really into the architecture, but their friends maybe weren't, and therefore they never got the opportunity to go. So I thought maybe there's something here, which is there a way to set up a travel company, which is something you can go on your own or with some friends and meet some like-minded people to really interesting places. So the first one I did, and I just put out a tweet, was a trip to Morfontaine, Chantilly, Fontainebleau, and Paris.
Which is not a trip that not only people don't get to go on, but there'll be loads of golfers who don't even know where those places are, what they are, how good they are.
Absolutely. And you know, it can't be that good because it's not Le Golf National, and they had the Ryder Cup at Le Golf National, exactly. You know. But to be honest, the kind of people who followed me, especially then, because the following was a little bit less than it is now, probably knew their stuff a little bit. And actually, wow, the opportunity to get onto those courses, yeah, is something which they hadn't thought was possible. Now, I'm not pretending it's cheap, because it absolutely isn't, because it's really hard to get access to those, and those guys know their worth and all that stuff. So that went really well, both in terms of the reaction I got and then the experience that I had and the other guests who came on it. So then I started thinking, right, how do we put together maybe a few more of these? Now, I've spent quite a bit of time. I've been to Australia twice now to play golf, and just loved it out there. The first time I went a few years ago, just put the whole itinerary together myself, but there's quite a lot of logistical stuff with it. If you go onto the Royal Melbourne website or the Victoria website, you won't see which days of the week you can play. You won't see how much it costs. And frankly, it isn't the easiest thing to put together. So I put together a trip to Australia. By now, I'd started up a bit of a mailing list to people if you'd like to hear about trips. Put out one tweet and one email at about 9 o'clock in the morning, and the trip had sold out by 3 o'clock that afternoon.
Wow.
And that was the bit of the moment that said, oh, there is something here. Yeah. So I immediately called around all the clubs and the airlines we were using over there, the hotels, and said, could we do another one the week after? And we could. So I've got a month in Australia coming up next March.
Well, that's not terrible.
Playing these amazing courses.
So what kind of trip is that? You know, for people listening, what kind of itinerary would you say is a typical UK golf guy trip?
So we did one actually to Ireland, to the northwest of Ireland, to Donegal a few weeks ago. And before we went, we had a Zoom call for all the participants to get to meet each other, because there were quite a few single guys there. So I think important for people to meet each other. It was a mix, actually, male and female. We got Mr. Tom Doak along. So he came onto the Zoom call to talk about one of the courses we were playing, Rosapenna. Again, the kind of thing which, if you book through one of the people you'll be familiar with in the UK, you're not going to get that with your golf calendar.
No.
Your golf travel, that just isn't what they do, and that's absolutely understandable. And then on the trip, we'd mix up, so you'd play with different people every day. We'd do a little bit of a talk about the courses. In the evenings, we'd eat together, we'd organise that. So a real sense of camaraderie coming through. Now, equally, I'm keen, so when we're in Australia for 10 days, not to overschedule it either, because I don't want everyone feeling they're living in each other's pockets. It's important people could do their own thing. So that was something which I enjoyed. I'm a bit of a perfectionist when it comes to things have to be just so, which I think hopefully works for the clients, because they hopefully don't see that. But in terms of how much work is going into it, it looks effortless and smooth. But a lot of work goes into making something look effortless and smooth.
Yeah. The effortless swan swimming on the, yeah, gliding on the water, and the feet kicking underneath.
And the legs are going like hell. So you know, to your point about how did it end up, I probably hadn't been utterly, I'm going to be a travel person. I've traveled a lot. But it was because of the success of some of those things that made me do it. And then it's really taken on a new life again in the last few months, because last summer, a friend of mine asked me, could I help out a couple of guys from the States who are looking to come over to Scotland? A guy called Andy Johnson and his friend Brendan Porath, who some of you might know on the Fried Egg.
A proper podcast.
Just like this. And they were looking to come to Scotland. Andy's never played in Scotland before. So I put together a bit of an itinerary for them. They stayed at my house, actually. We played Muirfield straight off the plane and had a fantastic experience. So Andy talked about that on his show. And then at another US-based society called the Outpost Club had heard it. Now, the Outpost Club's been going for 12, 13 years. It's got 800 members, and these are guys who are total and utter golf nuts. They just love playing golf. They love playing golf at great courses. They have 60 events in the States every year, but they did some international stuff, but maybe not as much as they could do, and they were dealing with lots of different providers. So they came to me and said, is there an opportunity here, do you think, to work together? So we then thrashed that out. How's it going to work? What does it need from me? What does it need from them? And again, probably the fact that I do have a commercial background helped, because even though I'm not a travel person, well, we could bring some of that expertise in. What I absolutely am is someone knows, you know, how do we put together something that works commercially, but how do we get something that works for their members? And that's the real key. Yeah. What do they want as
who
a member
discerning,
of the Outpost?
Will travel a lot, yeah, higher end kind of stuff.
Yeah. How do we get propositions that work for them? What does an itinerary look like wherever that is in the world? A lot to Ireland, a lot to Scotland, but there's England as well. I've got a group of 16 to the south of Spain. We've got another group in Australia. You know, how do we put together an itinerary that works? The fact I've been doing these trips for myself, my friends for 20 years, means I'm able to bring that view to it. So we launched that business earlier this year. We set up a company called Outpost Overseas, which is primarily for Outpost Club members, but also we will put the trips I'm doing for UK Golf Guy into that. And if you as a member of the public wanted to come along, then again, we can do that as well. And that's really supercharged what I was doing. So in some ways, incredibly lucky to have got to the position where that's there. But I'd also spent a lot of years trying to do a lot of things before ending up there. Now, realistically, if I hadn't decided to put out that tweet about a trip to Paris, you know, a few years ago, and hadn't ended up there, Would I be working golf? I'm not sure, genuinely. I've got a wife and two kids, and we've got a family, you know, that we need to support. And I think this absolutely is working and will allow us to do that. But I had to try quite a few different things before we landed up there.
Well, that's why I wanted particularly to do this podcast with you. So I think the two questions that I get most regularly on through social media.
Yeah.
Number one, it would be, Sam, I'm going to such and such a place. Where else should I play in the area?
Mm-hmm.
The second most off question is what we've just said. You know, how do I work in golf? You know, I have a job in the quote unquote real world, but I would much rather golf is my passion. How did you do it? How did you get from having a normal life to working in golf? Because I pinch myself every day that I get to work in this fabulous industry. And I think a lot of the people that listen to this podcast perhaps have worked in it for a long time. You know, there are lots of greenkeepers and course managers and industry folk, but then there are also plenty of people who, like me in a former life, just have an incredible passion for it without necessarily knowing the industry. So the fact that you and I together, really, post-COVID, have gone on that transition from more of a finance world background into the golfing space. And every time we've met up, we've kind of bounced these ideas. This is, what are you doing? This is what I'm doing. And it's funny that you started with the writing and getting involved in some of the ranking magazines, which is what I did. And then with the drone photography, doing some for the clubs.
Yeah.
I did that as well. And then starting to do some white labeled film stuff and making a few films yourself. Like, you're fabulous every hole at Ardfin, and you did one North Berwick as well, didn't you?
Yeah.
And it's just funny how we trod similar paths and ended up in different places, but that portfolio approach to, well, God, if you're going to have any success out of it, going to have to try and do half a dozen different things.
Yeah.
Make a little bit of success out of all of them and hope that added together, it's enough for it to still be viable. And then find something that works.
Absolutely. No, I think that's spot on. I think also doing them really well. So putting in a lot of effort. You know, I did a drone series early this year, which was Scotland's Ultimate 18 Holes, I called it. And there was every hole was from a different course. God, I must have got up to do that so many early mornings. And sometimes I remember driving to Prestwick. There was a slither of cloud in the way. I drove home to Gull and did it again the next morning. Still cloudy despite my app. Did three trips. Now, it would have been easy to have just done it after the first one, said it's fine, but it wasn't. It wasn't perfect.
The light has got to showcase. The low sun has got to showcase the contours on the ground. Otherwise,
exactly,
it doesn't tell the story.
And you can actually apply that almost to anything else. So, you know, if the trips that I organize, you know, things will happen, but you can plan for a hell of a lot of them. If you're not using a coach company who are going to be really, really good, if you're not, you know, thinking those extra touches. So who can I get involved? What can we do on top of that just to make it a little bit different? I think it's just so important to do that. The other thing I would say as an industry, as I get to meet more people now through it, is, you know, the kindness of strangers. I was really, really taken aback how not how easy it was to get into the industry, but how easy it was just to start. So right at the beginning,
people root for you, don't they?
Yeah.
They want you to succeed. If you're going to try something, I'm exactly the same, had the exact same experience in, oh, wow, you know, giving it a good go. Well, if you're a nice enough guy and you try and you give it back and all the rest of it, then people have been so generous with me.
I mean, it's incredible. So right at the beginning, I'd been running the website for a few years, which are mainly course reviews I'd done. But I've got a blog where I write occasionally some stuff. And I was coming away with a friend of mine. We'd been playing some courses. We'd played Swinley Forest. That's right, the first time. And I remember an article that Jeff Ogilvie had written about Swinley Forest, saying it might not be the best course in the world, but it's definitely one of my 10 favorites. And he explained why it was, because he could play it with his mother and his auntie and his father, and everyone got it around, had great fun. I thought that would be really interesting for a series. What if I asked people the 10 favorite courses they've got? I had maybe 1,000 Twitter followers right at the moment, so this was not that I was somewhat one that people would immediately be thinking of to help. So I sent a message on Twitter to Zach Blair in the back of the taxi coming back from Swinley. And by the time the taxi had arrived at our hotel, he'd given me his 10 favourite with some great words for why. And I was like, wow, you know, this guy doesn't know me from Adam. He'd never heard of me. And yet, so helpful. So then I sent a note to Mike Clayton, who is just such a lovely guy, so responsive. You know, he immediately got back.
Yeah.
And then I sent another one to Jeff Shackelford. He got straight. And then suddenly all these people who I've admired, you know, really looked up to.
And I'm sure you thought unapproachable.
Yeah,
and
yeah. Absolutely want to help. And now I see that. I deal a lot with the clubs and the courses now, obviously, when I'm putting together tours. And again, you know, not exclusively, I'll be honest with you, but 90% of the people, just so welcoming, so friendly. I took a group, as I said, over to Ireland. The Caseys at Rosapenna, you know, I don't think there are two nicer human beings out there in terms of what they're doing, but doing whatever they can to make our trip a success. And when you meet people like that, and when you see so many people who genuinely want you to do well, it's a huge encouragement.
I think, I have this theory, that the golf industry weeds out the people that it doesn't want in the golf industry.
Yeah.
Like, if you're not the kind of person, like the Caseys are a great example of it. They are lucky enough to play in the Renaissance Cup.
Yep.
And you were over there as well at St. Patrick's. God, they couldn't have done more for us that week, could they?
Yeah.
And I don't think it was because it was Tom Doak's event, and of course they want to show the course off to the best of its ability and the hospitality and everything else. But every single group that passes through will get that same.
Well, I'll give you a story about them without this making a Rosapenna loving. I had this group there a couple of weeks ago before we ate the last round. So we'd played the last round. We had a dinner with the presentations. I did a bit of a chat with the two of them, talk us through the history of the course, what you're trying to do with Rosapenna, you know, what you're doing with St. Patrick's. And they were great. Had the discussion. Everyone loved it. The next morning, we're checking out early, and our coach is there, and the two of them are running our luggage out and putting it into the truck. And one of the guys who's on the trip, who was a very successful businessman, sold his business for a huge amount of money, was saying, wow, you know, these guys are going to be super successful because someone who cares much about the customer, who cares about the client, who wants them to have a great experience, these guys deserve to be successful and probably will. And actually, I think, you know, I can take something from that. We're always learning, aren't we? As I think about the service I want to provide for people who come on trips with me, with the Outpost, it's that attention to detail. And yeah, we are going to go above and beyond because we want you to have an experience which is truly special.
Yeah. Well, let's talk, if we may, just briefly on the Outpost thing. Because when you were describing it and your journey into the business that you now operate, one of the things that I found interesting with your clear business acumen coming through was the opportunity that you found with the people who were there. And it almost seemed like you reverse engineered a business to cater for that opportunity. And there are a lot of people I find that would say, oh, I've got this great idea. This is what I'm going to do. And then I'm going to take that great idea and that business and I'm going to make it work. And you seem to have done that the entire opposite way around and said, well, here's the potential customers and the opportunity. How can I build a business that caters to what they're actually looking for?
I think to an extent. I mean, I think the Outpost guys, who are very, very, very smart people who built the Outpost Club in the States really successfully, knew there was something more they could do with it. And I guess it was when I sat down and spoke with them, when we really thrashed through what could that be, what could that look like. I think, you know, flexible thinking, absolutely. I think if either party had gone in and said, this is exactly what we want it to be, it would have been really tough. So we had to be flexible in terms of thinking. And we're going to learn, right? We've only been doing this thing for a few months. Every trip that we do, whether that's an escorted one, as we call it, where we go with people, or if it's a trip when they want to go with their friends, getting feedback is so, so important. The easiest thing to do in business is to say, phew, we got through that, on to the next thing. The thing you will learn at so much more is when you speak to people, okay, great, you had a really good time, but what could have been better? What's that 1%, you know? What are those extra things that you can just do to keep on elevating it? Because I think with all businesses, you know, if you're sitting there as a course manager, as a club manager, what are the things that, that you can constantly look at just to make a little bit of difference? I see it when I go back to clubs. You know, if I go back to see courses again, and you just see, here's a few little things that have changed, but boy, oh boy, when you add those things up, I might not have been to a course for 5 or 6 years, and I go back and all these little one percenters make such a difference. And again, that's something going back right to the beginning of my career at Proctor was all about that. What are those special moments, the things you can do, the incrementalism? So taking that into what we're doing now, I think is absolutely vital.
I mean, how fascinating is that, that you've just given something there that I'm sat there thinking, well, there's another portfolio, another strand, if you wanted it,
yeah,
as a business there in golf. There are so many different things, but the value to a golf club in that kind of feedback and that kind of approach on how they can improve their product.
Yeah.
Because what a competitive industry. The high end, you know, everyone's going after the American tourist money for the golf courses. The green fees, which is something I would like to ask you about, but green fees in Britain, as we know, have gotten so expensive in recent years.
Yeah.
And they're not being targeted at the Brits, they're being targeted
absolutely not
at the Americans. So by nature of doing that, the top clubs are competing every year for a finite, you would imagine, pool of people. Maybe it grows slightly, but it's not growing as quickly as the green fees have inflated.
Yeah, absolutely.
So they're all in competition with one another. Being that bit better and offering that bit more and being the best service they can is worth so much.
Absolutely. And look, I think there is actually, we've just come up with a new business idea. There's almost two different parts. There's that for those top end guys. You know, how are you at Castle Stewart compared to King's Barnes going to make the experience one that people want to go and say you're going to be the first on the list? But actually, I think almost as interesting from that is maybe the next couple of tiers down. And a lot of it is obvious, but you know, I probably go to 60 different UK clubs last year I went to. And just from that moment you arrive, from the signage to what happens when you go into the clubhouse to what happens when you go into the pro shop, what's that experience like at every single spot along that before you've even got to the course? And then when you're in the course, you know, course, is it easy to get round? What's the signage like? You know, just little things like that. The experience when you come away can be so different. It's between two different clubs, and it doesn't have to be the super clubs at the top who are charging ridiculous amounts for every round. You can do that at all levels of the business. And, you know, what was it last year? I went to Pitt Lochry last year. That was a really interesting business case. I mean, what you'll see is a lot of places in the UK are really struggling at the moment from the catering side. I was up in the Highlands last week, and it was obvious that some places were catering. They don't have a membership which is large enough to support. It might be in a rural area. They're having problems with staffing. This will be happening in clubs up and down the country. Went to Pitt Lochry, which is what's really interesting. What they'd taken is that clubhouse area and made it a community hub almost. So when I was there on a Thursday morning, you know, the number of people there eating and drinking and enjoying the facility, not that many were actually playing the golf. But they'd taken that opportunity and said, what can we do with that? So I think there's a huge amount. And what I do try to do is have a chat with the general manager or the secretary afterwards. But, you know, they don't necessarily want me to come along and say, here's all the things that could be better. But if they ask, there's often just little things which you could really try to point them to.
It's like that old Samuel Walton quote thing, isn't it? You know, if you can take things from your competitors and just do them that bit better, well, then that adds up to Walmart,
absolutely,
in his case,
absolutely,
and a great business.
You
don't have to reinvent the wheel for yourself at every single club, at every single golf course. No, I think there's enormous value in that. But okay, can we talk about your golf course rankings? Because you have your own system of doing it on the UK Golf Guy website, but you've also been involved in a couple of the ranking panels and
I think you're being a little bit grand saying I've got my own one on the website. It comes back to when I really started seeing lots of courses in Europe. I was playing a course called Terre Blanche in the south of France, which is a very nice course, and came off the course and I'd won our competition for that particular week, whatever. And between us, we had maybe all put in 10 euros, so I had a bit of money to spend in the shop. And rather than get another t-shirt, there was a book there called The Peugeot European Guide, or The Guide to European Golf. And the Peugeot Guide to European Golf, a bit like the Michelin Guide it was trying to do, but actually had huge breadth. It had over, I think, 1,000 courses in Europe, including the UK and Ireland. And each one had a page write-up. and God, this ages me. This is probably the relatively early days of the internet as well. So that amount of resource wasn't as much as it is out there at the moment. So I picked up that, and they had a ranking system where, I mean, it's a bit stupid, where the top course has a 19 out of 20. There was nothing more than 19 in the whole of the UK and Europe. And really it went down to maybe 12 or 13. So that was kind of the ranking. And actually, when I started the website, I just used that because, frankly, that's what I was used to. And I went away with my friends, we'd very easily say we'd play a course, and after a few holes, oh, this feels like a 16, or this feels like a 14. Oh, do you think this is an 18? Because we had that almost as a common way of talking, the currency between us. So I put that on the website. It's a bit like Tom Doakes almost, because it's kind of, it's still got, you know, he's got 0 to 10, but really apart from the courses he's really trying to wind up, he doesn't use a zero very much. There's only 15
tens. But if you chop
them
in half, you know, if an average golf course is probably gets maybe a 3 or a 4 on the Doakes scale, and it's built to differentiate at the higher end,
yes,
rather than,
yes,
you know, if it's a bad golf course, he's probably not going to be visiting it full stop.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's, for me, that's what I use, and that's what we use when we talk about golf, yeah, courses, because it works.
And probably if I'd heard of Tom Doak when I did it and I'd heard the Doak scale, I might well have started using that one to begin with. So look, I use that, and I think I've got about 150 reviews on the website of courses. I've got another 150 draft probably somewhere, which I need to get round to sometime. But where was I going? Yeah, so I think within that, I do have them in an order, but I'm thinking of just moving alphabetically. So all of those 19s, you know, who am I to say whether Shinnecock's better than St Andrews and it's better than Royal Melbourne? I've been lucky, I've played lots of these places, so I can have an opinion. The opinion I try to give isn't one just about architecture. I read stuff on architecture, but I've got friends, yourself included, who are far more versed on that. I try to write those reviews really from the viewpoint of an average golfer, looking for good experiences. What does it look like? What I will say is I only rate the course itself. I don't rate the practice facilities or the welcome at the bag drop or any of that stuff. It is all just about the course. But I'm not doing it just on the pure architecture point of view. So sometimes I see other rankings and they slightly wind me up because actually, yeah, but who are they targeted at? And I think with any ranking, and there's loads of them out there from the magazines, some are very good, one or two are absolutely awful, I think. And just knowing who you're going for, what angle are you coming from, is really important. I'm coming from the average person.
Do you think, like many things, I suppose, that you need to know... The rankings need to know what they're trying to be in the first place. They need to have their own identity.
Yeah.
And there's nothing wrong with coming up with a list that looks very different if it clearly is designed to appeal to people who have a certain preference and a certain type of course that they like.
And I think that's right. But I don't know how many people reading a golf magazine or going to a website would appreciate that nuance.
Yeah.
So even though...
And they try and be all things to all men.
Yeah. Yeah, and even when they might print the criteria, not that many people actually read those or really understand it. And I'm in two minds. The reason I think rankings are good is that I think it kind of gives you a good idea, if you're in an area, of what courses, you know, you should really think about seeing if you can. So I think they work from that point of view. I find it almost impossible to get worked up about should a course be number 2 or number 4. You know, well, that comes down to just personal opinion, and it really doesn't matter. It really doesn't matter.
Also, I find this interesting. So I was on the phone with the guys from Cookie Jar earlier in the week. So most people know they're big friends of mine. They've been up to the Outer Hebrides,
yeah,
and Kintyre as well the past week or so. So... That's an area of the country that I particularly love. I think it's brilliant. You know, there are people on record, like Jim Hartzler is a great example of someone who has spent a lot of time there,
yep,
and given us a lot of love and affection as it rightly deserves. But the places we ended up talking about when we were catching up afterwards, and I said, oh, what do you think of such and such a place? The places we ended up talking about were Carradale,
mm-hmm,
which is a 9-hole...
Yeah,
golf course on halfway down the Kintyre Peninsula facing Arran. It's got a pretty average opening hole, but the second hole is out of this world stunning.
Yeah.
Would it make a top 100 list in the UK? No. Would it make the top 100 list in Scotland? Probably not. It's just
a tiny little
nine-hole golf course. But should you play it if you're going to Macrahanish? Absolutely.
Well, I'm glad
yes.
We haven't teed this up, but I'm launching a trip next week, which is going to Macrahanish, and we're stopping off at Carradale on the way down
there
the road.
Go.
Because otherwise, if all you do is try to find the big names and play those big names, your golf experience is going to be a fraction of what it could be.
Yeah, I mean, unless you're like Sprezzatura and you're eating at a Michelin-star restaurant every night, it's nice to have that bit of diversity, and you know, sometimes you just want a sandwich.
Yeah,
and,
yeah, yeah.
And there's nothing wrong with
that. But you want it to be a good sandwich, a well-made sandwich, which you're going to enjoy rather than an awful sandwich. So that's where I think
and that's
you can play a
an example of one. But there are others, you know, they always, we ended up talking about Try and Isle of Harris. And those places where you have, with limited ingredients, you end up with something really special.
Yeah.
You're not really going to just find them on the top 100 list because...
Yeah.
Realistically, what they're working with isn't going to be enough to compete
Absolutely
with the
agree.
Big boys.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But should you play them? Of course you
For
should
sure.
play them. Well, that's interesting. So obviously you have your own, but then you work with, or you're on the panel with Chris Bertram?
Yes, for today's golfer. So I've been on his paddles for probably 3 or 4 years, maybe a little bit longer now. Yeah.
And one of the things that you always do really well is when he puts out a new list, you compile it and do a great deal of analysis on how that list compares to previous years.
Yeah.
When did you start doing that?
I don't just do it for him. I think the first one I did maybe was a continental European one before I'd even met him or talked to him, and he liked what I'd written there, so I asked me to join his panel because I'd played a lot of them. I do it also for the Golf Magazine worldwide list, which is probably... I mean, it's probably the number one worldwide list now. It's the one, if you're trying to play the top 100 courses, that's the list everyone goes off of. So I did that analysis for that, and that's interesting as I go around to various different places in the world. A lot of people have seen that analysis. It's a bit weird. A lot of the golf media companies, the magazines, don't have great traction on social media. And partly that's because of the algorithm. It's because of the way they set themselves up. But some of those magazines got hundreds of thousands of followers, but hardly any engagement when they post the list. Whereas if I put them up, and I normally do a bit of a graphic with that, it seems to get lots of traction and lots of people talking about it. And to be honest with you, I mean, if you look in the UK, there's probably four different ranking lists. There's Today's Golfer, there's National Club Golfer, top100.com and the Golf Monthly ones. The approach that Chris takes suits my eye. I quite like it, but I'm not going to do it forever. I think that all panels kind of need to have turnover. It'll get stale, so I'll probably do it for another year or two and then either not sit on another one or go off and do something else.
What have you noticed? What trends have you noticed over the last few years of compiling those and looking at how lists have changed? Because I remember you posting some things from years gone by, magazines with panels from the 90s.
They're great looking at. So you can go back not that far. There's a Golf Monthly one, 2007, Royal Dornoch, I think, might be in like just make the top 60 or something. And now it seems the top 20 in the world. It's like, wow, that's nuts. There was definitely a trend in the late 1990s when a new golf course opened, they would be very... heavy on the PR. Frankly, they'd be heavy on the spending as well with the golf magazines, and they would make quite a splash. If you look at, I've done some analysis of courses that have entered the top 100, how many of them have stayed in as a new course? 90% of new courses are in for one or two editions and then they go down. Well, that's a bit of a problem for me, because either the panel didn't really know what good was, if they thought it was good and they stuck it in for the first couple of years, then it went out, or there's commercial interest there, which meant it was in their interest to put it in. Now, to me, I've got no interest in that. That just wouldn't be something I'd want to be part of. And I'm going back in time now. That's not to say that all take the same approach. But if you go back 20 years ago, that was absolutely the case. It was also that thing about what is good and who are we to say what is good. But that view of very manicured parkland courses, very green, trying to get Augusta conditioning when they opened, yada, 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 that was seen as good for a while. I think now, and probably social media is part of it as well, just in terms of people seeing a lot of different places, there's definitely a trend, as you know now, away from long, green and penal to broader browner and more strategic. That's just a trend.
Championship and golf courses. That's what people wanted. They were the only kind of golf courses that were built. They were the only things that were valued. And that's a lot of what we try and undo. Sounds a bit harsher than I intend. But, you know, golf courses were lengthened for the sake of being longer, arguably.
Yeah.
How do they go about lengthening it? Well, you move every tee box back, the golf course is longer. Well, yeah, of course it is. But now where the drives are ending up might mean that there's a danger issue with a green that is now where most drives are finishing.
Yeah.
Or it might be that you're walking back for 20 seconds after every green, which doesn't seem like much, but it adds up and it stops the people hitting their approach shots into the green on the hole that you've just vacated.
Yeah.
It means they have to wait, otherwise they might hook one straight into your eyeballs, or, you know, all of these things.
And all of that adds up to the experience. So I think certainly with Chris's panels on today's golfer, that is something taken into consideration. You know, how enjoyable is it? Now, some critics would say that pendulum might swing too far, and actually is there a preference for courses which maybe don't have the same executional tests as some other rankings. But personally, I want the kind of courses where the average person is going to have really good fun, enjoy themselves, but still have some strategic tests given to them. It's good to see those ones doing well.
But that's an age-old thing, isn't it? And again, another thing that we always talk about, it's a quote from Harry Colt, say you design aggressively for the scratch golfer and accommodating for the longer handicap golfer.
Yeah.
And that's what he wrote 100 and something years ago. It's just as relevant now as it ever was, because Tom Simpson, another quote, the 12 handicap golfer is the mainstay of all golf clubs.
Yeah.
It's just the same now. We're a bell curve of talent throughout as golfers. There are more in the middle than there are at each extreme. But everyone has equal right to enjoy it. And if you only design for one specific case, if you only make it penal and narrow and tough, and okay, the 1% will say, walk off and say, what a great golf course. I've just gotten beaten up, but I shot 72 and I'm very happy with that. But that's not a golf course
and
that
you kind of
play.
Lost the other 95%. Look, it's interesting, given what you do, as an architect, as an architecture firm, something you touched on earlier was green fees. And without a doubt, green fees in the UK continue to go ahead of inflation. And I absolutely understand that costs are going up significantly. I wrote an article about this. Every year I do a review of the green fees of the top 100 courses. And I think the theory that I posited this time was at the very, very, very expensive top end, those guys are just continuing to get in as much money as they can. And actually, the proportion of that green fee income they spend on looking after the golf courses is relatively low. When you go down a couple more tiers, it's really important for those guys because they're getting inflation and it is something which they need just to cover the costs. One of the problems, I think, at the top end is that there are, when I say the top end, maybe the top 20, 30, 40 courses, there are some clubs now which have got a lot of money and probably more money than they've ever had and potentially more money than they need. And some of those are now saying, right, how do we spend this money? Because one of the things you'll often hear back from clubs is, but we don't make any profit. We're not a profit organization here. Well, no, but you spend money on upgrading facilities because that's what the people who want to pay those green fees want to spend. And sometimes tinkering with the courses. And I think sometimes doing, or potentially risking doing work on courses because they have money to spend, which may be good from your point of view as an architecture firm, but it's really, really risky.
Yes and no. I mean, we talked about one example that we won't go into today, but we would only ever advocate change if we think that it's clearly better.
Yeah. And I'm not sure everyone does that, truth be told. I think some people are spending the client's money, and sometimes I look at that and think, did you really need to spend that money?
But do you know what the best thing about it is? I think with my architecture hat on from a business case, there's actually a lot of fixing of golf courses, of restitution of the places that did have the money over the last 10, 20, 30 years, and they did have 10 million euros or 10 million pounds burning a hole in their pocket And they think, right, how can we make this golf course better? Well, let's call up so-and-so.
Yeah.
And let's build a new par three. Let's build a new set of greens. Let's change this. And if that hasn't, if that's impacted the flow and the routing of the golf course, you're always going to have times when boundary issues, the ball going further, lengthening a golf course, those things will organically require a golf course to change. But actually, a lot of what we do is almost fixing things that perhaps haven't been as fully thought out as they could have been.
Yeah.
But one of the things I'm interested in is how the way it's gone and the way that growth of green fee revenue at the top end, how sustainable do you think that is as a business?
I think the pound to the dollar is key. The pound to the dollar is at 124 this morning. It's relatively cheap. You know, the cost of living in the States is high. It's high here, but when Americans come over, they do comment on the good value that they're getting and how cheap things are. If that were to go back to 180 towards 2, there would be massive problems for that top end, because suddenly, you know, that they would be 50% more expensive. That would cause some issues. Not for every visiting golfer, but for a lot of them.
Because the perception, I think, is, oh, the Americans would just pay whatever. They don't even look at it. They don't even care this is expensive. Or what feels expensive to us as Brits, you know, the fact that the old course quite recently went from 180-ish.
Went from 180 to 295. It'll be over 300 soon, yeah.
And it was always one of the best value courses, certainly on the open rotor. And in terms of the quality of the golf course versus the green fee, yes, of course, £180 is expensive for anyone. But in terms of where it sat amongst the other golf courses, it represented a bit better value.
Yeah.
And the fact they've just clicked their fingers and almost overnight it's gone. But I wonder, not every American is a billionaire coming over with no concept of money.
No. And look, without a doubt, the price sensitivity will be a little bit lower for people who are doing a once-in-a-lifetime trip than for someone who wants to play a course in their area. What I do think is a crying shame is that there are generations of young golfers, in fact, not just young golfers, of British golfers, who will probably never be able to play our courses. And even though we do really pat ourselves on the back that, isn't it great in the UK, anyone can play any course? No. Almost. Isn't that fantastic? Well, it is. But equally, it might be a lifetime, once a lifetime experience for them just to play one of those courses once because they're so expensive. Something I'd like to see, it's something which happens in restaurants in London, I think, where they have like a week where you can eat at really good restaurants for a fraction of the price you would be able to the rest of the year. Wouldn't it be great, not in the third week of November, but if just every club took 1 week a year, and they said, right, for this 1 week a year, we are going to invite visitors, and rather than being £250 for a course that just might get into the top 100, we're only going to be £50 that week. It's just for local people or just for people from that country, and when it's gone, it's gone. But at least it gives people a bit more hope, because it's just getting out of control at the top.
Do you remember when Hamilton, the musical, came on in America, and the tickets were trading for...
Yeah.
Like five figures on StubHub or Ticketmaster or whatever.
I think I was in the room when it happened, actually.
Oh, wow. Good, great. Yeah. And they'd have their ham for ham thing, you know, Hamilton's on the $10 bill. And they'd have a lottery every day, and it built up, it whipped up a storm. And everyone wanted to go to these things. And golfers, they all want to go and play, you know, Hoylake this year, where I'm lucky enough to play, or Gullen or Muirfield or North Berwick, all these places, but they are beyond the reach of a lot of...
It is, and look, you could save up to do it once, one course, once every few years for some people. Yeah, they could do that, but not being able to put together trips like we used to.
The other risk I wonder about, if you're only going after the Americans, which, let's face it, those top X number of people who have raised their green fees so substantially are really only going after the Americans, and maybe of an absolute minority of domestic travel. Yeah. One of the things that they've never had in America historically is the ability to play Lynx golf, the British style of the game in their country. But now, you know, you can go to Bandon Dunes or Cabot Highlands, or not Cabot Highlands, that's
yeah, Cabot or in Nova Scotia. Yeah.
Go to Nova Scotia or go to Sand Valley or go to Cabot Citrus Farms. You know, they're opening at a great rate, and Bandon OK Now is so successful that I think it's booked up a year in advance. But it represents, it's almost like they've taken the British business model of a good links, no frills golf course, taken it to America, and quite clearly have done it incredibly well due to the popularity.
No, I'm sure that's right. Having said that, when Muirfield opened its tee sheet for next year, it wasn't open very long before it was full. The same with Royal County Down, wasn't open until it's full.
They're the top of the pyramid. They are the absolute top of the shop. If you are course number 50 in the rankings or course number 70 in the rankings, and you're still going over those places, and they don't have the ranking list, they don't have the history of watching people win open championships or whatever it might be, they don't have the intangible attraction that is always going to fill the tee sheet.
Yeah.
Do you think that those courses that have perhaps priced themselves out of the UK domestic market are vulnerable from those effects?
I think it's vulnerable. I think they've got to be careful. Maybe too late. You don't go too far. I can think of a couple of examples now, whereas if I'm putting together a tour, I probably wouldn't include those courses, because even though they're really good, I just don't think they're good enough, and almost I don't want to encourage them. And I think that there are other tour operators I know who are doing the same. But I wouldn't underestimate just how special it is for these guys to come and play the great courses of our country, right? They often have been yearning for this for a lifetime. You know, I had a group last week of father and son, and it was just the most special thing that those two guys have been through for many, many years. Would they have had it in Bandon? They'd have had a great Bandon trip. But to see them playing the old course, we got them onto the old course through the lottery, and then had a great week playing a bunch of other courses. They, at the end of the trip, what they said is this is just, we just cannot do this at home. So even though I'm sure there's something in it, and I do think people have to be very careful what they're charging, I don't think it matters too much the top end for those guys, but I think the bit further down, yes, there's still something about coming to the home of golf, coming to Ireland, which gives them an experience which they'll just remember forever. That sounded like a bit of a marketing thing there, didn't it?
No, it sounds like you're enjoying your new life.
It's great. It's great. And it's funny, when I post on Twitter pictures of courses I'm at, you know, people do, as I said at the beginning, oh, I want to have your job. Believe me, there's a load of other stuff going on just to set all these up. But it's going so well. We are looking now to bring a couple of other people into the team as well.
Brilliant.
Which is just really exciting to be able to say an idea that came now to see it kind of growing to this, and I don't know where it's going to go next. I mean, I'm sure the outpost work, the UK Golf Guide trips, we're continuing doing those. I want to go to more and more interesting places, because I think there is a market for that. But then who knows what else? I think the one thing I've learned over the last few years is you don't close any doors. You do things that interest you, and there's a chance that you can make it work, and we seem to be on that path.
Very much so. Well, to finish, before we finish, can I ask then, we've talked and dismayed the British travelling golfers and said, well, you can't go here because not only are the green fees so expensive, but the hotels become more expensive, the restaurants become more expensive.
Yeah, yeah.
But there are still parts of the country where you can have a great trip. If you were doing a mid-range budget trip for a group of Brits who wanted to drive somewhere and play some, let's say, some links golf in the summer, where would you suggest they go and look?
Look, I've got a bit of a bias towards Scotland, given the amount of time I spend up here. That Kintyre area is just crazy. It's not as far as you think. You get to Glasgow, and once you get to Glasgow, you jump in the car, and within 3 hours, you're on the Kintyre Peninsula. You play Carradale, you play Macrahanish, Macdhu's, Dunaverty. Take a ferry, go over to Islay. You know, just beautiful place. The most expensive of those green fees of all those places I've talked about is Macrahanish, £125. Macdhu's, I think, £79. Carradale, you just put money in Honesty Box. Dunaverty's 30. Go across to Arran, play Shiskin. You know, that's really good value, and it's not as difficult to do as people think. again, the Highlands is another great area. What you see as a theme come through here, the places which are better value are harder to get to because fewer people go and therefore it's better value. Even without playing Castle Stewart and Royal Dornoch, right, you can still have a fantastic time up there playing so many other really, really nice courses. But then it's okay, go completely off the traditional beaten track. Go to the northeast of England, go to Dunstable, go to Bamborough, go to Gossick.
Right? The Northumbrian coast to go Seaton Carew, Gossick, Dunstanborough Castle, Onmouth Village.
Absolutely. And then you've got great options in terms of what kind of trip you want. If you want to have nice quiet nights in, then get yourself an Airbnb, which is still great value somewhere on the coast there. If you want to have a big night, go into Newcastle, go out to, you know, fantastic nights out you can have there.
Nice restaurants in Durham.
Yeah, yeah. So you know, a huge opportunity there. So I would say that would be another one which people just never think of doing. If you say you're going to go on a trip to the northeast of England, but believe me, you'd have a fantastic time.
And, you know, we've just rattled off a few there, but thinking about it, how many people go and play golf at Hartlepool?
Yeah.
Hartlepool starts, okay, it's got a slow start. You play a few parklandy holes, and then you get to this par three into the dunes, and you're like, holy shit, you know, this is amazing.
Is it? That sounds crazy. Yeah.
Hartlepool, brilliant. You drive under this tunnel of the railway track, and then there's a stretch in the middle. What I would say in my experience, and I don't know if this holds true for you as well, the places that are better value, that are off the beaten track, they're just not going to have 18 world-class holes.
Yeah.
They might have half a dozen that are pretty pedestrian, but then they'll have a stretch that is absolutely as good as anything anywhere.
And,
you know, Hartlepool is a great example of it. But how many people are going to go and play golf there? not many. But the ones who do, that stretch in the middle, they will thoroughly enjoy it.
Yeah.
And it's the same at, you know, the likes of Warkworth and Sea Houses. They've all got a few really good holes.
And it's easy to forget, not everyone's an architecture nerd as well. No. You know, not everyone wants to have all the
New Biggin by the Sea.
Yeah.
Go and enjoy New Biggin by the Sea. And you won't enjoy every single hole, but there is more than enough that means that you'll go home and tell your mates that you've had a great time.
And equally, with lots of those types of courses, they haven't tried to stretch it to 7,200 yards. They haven't tried to grow up the rough to make it more penal. They haven't put in the bunkers in the landing areas because the architecture said, you know, so actually you could probably have quite a lot of fun at them as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Oh, well, I'm glad that you've said two places that I completely agree are entirely worth traveling to. And like you say, not hard to get to, realistically.
Yeah.
Compared to jumping on a plane and flying to somewhere, like everyone will happily go on a trip to Portugal, but you can go play these brilliant, historic, fun links golf courses for a fraction of the price locally. You can drive there, you can get good accommodation, and they're still out there.
And have a night out down the big market in Newcastle. It's all you could ask for.
Well, should we end on that point? David, thanks so much for coming.
Thank you for
coming on. No, delighted. I think that those two questions, like we say, you know, where should we go and play golf? Well, we talked about that. How can you have a career in golf? Well, you're one of the great, someone who epitomizes how it can be done and done in such a short period of time as well.
Lovely. Thanks a lot, Sam.
Cheers, David.
Cheers.